Welcome to the Sicilian Secret Diet Plan Podcast. This podcast is written and presented to you by husband and wife team Dr. Sandra Camerata and Dr. Giovanni Campanile. Sandra is a psychiatrist and was born and raised in Sicily, and Giovanni is a cardiologist. They have written the Sicilian Secret Diet Plan book and podcast in order to introduce a wider audience to the wonderful taste and health benefits of the Sicilian Mediterranean diet, which will lead you onto a path of longevity and improved health span, the reduction of disease in the later part of your life. The goal is to live not only longer, but better with improved vitality and joy of life. Their motto is Be Well Deliciously.
What an exciting day today from the Sicilian Secret Diet Podcast. Today, we have Marion Nessel. Her biography is a podcast of its own. She is a consumer advocate, nutritionist, award-winning author, and an academic who specializes in the politics of food and dietary choice. Her research examines scientific, economic, and social influences on food choice and health, which emphasize the role of food industry marketing. Her books explore how politics affect food production, dietary intake, food safety, and human and planetary health. She is the author of the classic, Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health. Food Politics won awards from the Association of American Publishers, the James Beard Foundation, and World Hunger Year. Her second book, Safe Food, The Politics of Food Safety, won the Steinhardt School of Education Griffiths Research Award in 2004. Her other books, What to Eat, Pet Food Politics, The Chihuahua in the Coal Mine, Feed Your Pet Right, Why Calories Count from Science to Politics, won multiple awards. One of her latest book, Why Calorie Count from Science to Politics, won the Book of the Year from the International Association of Culinary Professionals in 2012. Eat, Drink, and Vote, another of her famous book, An Illustrated Guide to Food Politics, won an IACP Book Award in 2014, as did Soda Politics, taking on Bit Soda and winning. And in 2018, she wrote Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Screw the Science of What We Eat, which exposes how the food industry corrupts scientific research for profit, and one of nature's best science books of the year. In 2020, she wrote, Let's Ask Marion, What Do You Need to Know About the Politics of Food, Nutrition, and Health? And her latest book, Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, was released in October of 2022. Marion Nessel is the Emerita Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. She is the Professor of Sociology at the New York University. She holds appointments as Visiting Professor in the Cornell Division of Nutritional Science. Her degrees include a PhD in Molecular Biology and an MPH in Public Health Nutrition, both from the University of California, Berkeley. She has appeared frequently in many documentary films, among them Supersize Me, A Place at the Table, Fed Up, El Susto, and Code Blue. We could continue to go on and talk about all her awards, achievement, but we're really excited to hear directly from her the journey that has taken her to be one of the most exciting and famous people that have worked for nutrition, science, and politics.
This discussion with Marion is very exciting to us because the goal of our podcast is to pass on information about food and the way food is marketed and how food can affect health. And Marion is one of the most influential people on the planet that has written extensively about this specific subject. And we're going to talk about her book, Food Politics, and her memoir book, Slow Cooked. In addition, we'll talk about how food is advertised, the pester factor that food companies use to influence children, to influence, in turn, their parents to buy mostly unhealthy foods. We'll talk about her book, Soda Politics, and her other book, What to Eat. We'll also talk about how, during COVID, the Defense Production Act was used to protect certain foods, maybe not the healthiest foods that could have been protected. We'll talk about obesity rates in America, and specifically the childhood obesity rates, how supermarkets make you buy more, why do people make unhealthy food choices, the way federal farm subsidies in the U.S. government may promote foods for animals and not necessarily healthy foods for people. Healthcare by food. This is a new program by the American Heart Association where it's actually food as medicine is implemented structurally, and how processed food can promote depression, how studies have shown that ultra-processed foods can lead to weight gain. And then finally, Marion's blog and her website, foodpolitics.com. So with no further ado, we will now start our interview with Marion, and we are super excited.
So, Marion, where are you coming from? How did you end up becoming so involved in food politics? Most known piece of work, and then all the other work that you continue to do. Your last publication, now Slow Cooked, which probably tells a lot of where you started. Tell us.
I wrote Slow Cooked, which is a memoir. I usually write very serious, detailed reference books about food politics, and this memoir was a very sharp departure. Memoirs are about how you feel about what happened to your life, and I call it my first work of fiction. I usually write nonfiction books, but I tell the story in the book about what happened because, in a sense, you know, I had an epiphany. I was on my first teaching job, and I was at Brandeis University and in the biology department there, teaching cell and molecular biology. I got handed a nutrition course to teach. I didn't know anything about it, but I learned very quickly. And it was like falling in love. I never looked back. I just think that it's the best way to teach people about biology, about society, about anything, because everybody eats and everybody can relate to it. And so that was the first epiphany. The second one occurred when I was first teaching at New York University. And I went to a meeting at the National Cancer Institute in Washington, D.C. And it was a meeting on behavioral causes of cancer. And most of the people who were at this meeting were anti-smoking advocates. They were physicians and scientists who had been working. This was in the early 1990s, and people were still smoking. and they had been working for decades to try to get people to stop smoking. And I knew that smoking was bad for you. I knew that smoking caused lung cancer. And I knew that the cigarette industry did a lot of marketing of cigarettes, but I had never paid any attention to it. And these people gave talks in which they showed slides of cigarette marketing all over the world. And in particular, one of the talks was of cigarette marketing to children, not only in the United States, but also all over the world. And I had this just flash that we should be doing the same thing. We nutritionists should be doing the same thing for Coca-Cola and for companies that were selling products that were clearly not healthy if you consume too much of them, because they were using exactly the same marketing techniques. And so I walked out of that meeting thinking, time to pay attention. And I started paying attention. I started writing about ways in which food companies marketed foods that weren't particularly healthy. And there was I had a whole series of articles. And at the end of the 1990s, I figured out that it was time for a book. So I put those articles together and wrote some others. And that was food, that was the genesis of Food Politics, which came out 20 years ago.
And for the next 20 years, you've continued.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Continue to divulge, you know, the information that is necessary for people to understand.
Well, for one thing, Food Politics opened doors.
Right.
In ways that I hadn't anticipated. So I had a lot of speaking invitations. I wrote Food Politics because for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons was that I was extremely tired of going to meetings about childhood obesity, in which every single speaker said, "How are we going to educate mothers to feed their children better?" And never was there a speaker saying, "How are we going to put some restrictions on what food companies are doing to market junk foods to our kids?" I thought that conversation needed to be changed.
And I 100% agree. In our book, I have a chapter on "It's Not Entirely Your Fault," and it's about this. And also the way it's advertised to children, it's like hidden for children and not necessarily known to parents. So I think it's a very, very big problem.
Well, I think parents felt about it just the way I did before I had this flash of insight, which is, of course, there are cartoons on cereals marketed to kids. Of course, there are cartoons characters that are tied up with food companies. You don't even think about it. Once you start thinking about it, it completely changes the way you view these kinds of things. And you start looking at food companies as doing something pretty insidious, which is getting your kids to demand junk foods. Yeah. And it's called the pester factor. The object of the game is to get kids to pester their parents for these foods. And parents are busy, they're tired, they don't want to fight with their kids about food. Nobody wants to fight with their kids about food.
And the other successful part of that is that once the child becomes accustomed to that taste, it becomes a requirement. You know, we know a lot of these foods do trigger dopamine release, which triggers more search and anticipatory request for that release. And so it becomes a craving. And then the taste changes so much because now you have given a child so much sugar, and sugar is that immediate gratification.
Well, and the other big problem is now children eat 75% of their diet as ultra-processed foods, which has clear dangers in terms of their health.
Right. I mean, I don't think kids eat meals anymore, as far as I can tell. I don't know. I mean, I've written subsequent books about, so I have a book about sodas. I have a book about food industry marketing, food industry funding of nutritional research, always with results in the favor of the product. I'm working on a new edition now of a book, What to Eat, that came out in 2006. And I'm doing a new edition of that, which is a really big project.
Oh, great.
And looking at the food supply now and how much the food supply is engineered to try to get people to eat more food. You know, and as I'm fond of saying, the food industry is not a social service agency, and it's not a public health agency. It's a business. And its job is to sell more food, not less. And they don't care what the food is or what its effects are, as long as people will pay for it and spend a lot of money. And ultra-processed foods are really profitable.
The most important thing that I've seen is that people really do listen to you. They listen, they're paying attention to you. And they're paying attention to you because you've been perseverant, because of the way you speak, because you're bringing science to back up everything that you say, because, you know, you're coming from a place of love, right? I want this change to affect the people. I don't want to see disease. I don't want to see the obesity in children. I don't want... So people are paying attention to you. You're a woman scientist, so that is even a greater gift, greater to be listened to. And so you've had a great impact, and all your books have made some changes in people's awareness, but also in policies. And I like when you talk about the fact that people, these are systems we have to look at, right? Is not just one isolated thing. And that system is broken. The system is, you know, needs to be attacked or changed in different ways. So tell us a little bit about that. How did you come to understand the system?
Well, yeah. That's a really good question, because I think it went through stages. I started out in basic science and then switched to nutrition. I was very interested in nutrients at the beginning, but then I got more interested in food, and then I got more interested in food systems. So that was that's the progression over, you know, a pretty long career now, more than 40 years. And the food systems is the big new buzzword, and what it refers to is the entirety of what happens to food from the time it's produced, distributed, harvested, distributed, sold, consumed, wasted, the whole thing. And the point about it is that you really can't understand any one part of that without being able to see the whole picture at the same time. That's food system thinking. And so if I'm dealing with an individual who is having trouble monitoring what, or a family that's having trouble controlling what their kid is eating, because the kid is demanding things that they don't really think are good, but they don't want to fight with their kid, they're fighting a food system that is set up in order to make profit for food companies. So once you understand that they're not social service agencies, they're not public health agencies, they're businesses, they're trying to sell you more food at the highest price they can possibly get for it. And they want you to eat more frequently during the day, because the more times you eat, the more food you buy. They want you to eat in large portions, because you're eating more food. And all of our, you know, and public health doesn't enter into that. It's not their problem.
Yeah.
You know, and I have stories that I like to tell. And one of them was, I once went to a meeting at the White House on marketing foods to kids. It was during the era of Michelle Obama, when she had chosen childhood obesity as the issue she wanted to work on, I think because she thought it was a bipartisan issue that everybody could agree about. Everybody wants kids to be healthy. She learned differently quite quickly. But the at this meeting, at which she gave a terrific speech about how food companies should stop marketing junk foods to kids, we then broke up into smaller groups. And I was in a group with a large number of food industry executives, and one of them said, I wish we didn't have to market to kids. If it were up to me, we wouldn't. I don't think it's right, but our stockholders won't let us stop. And I thought, really? Just like that? You're saying it just like that?
Just like it is.
Just like it is.
And he understood it wasn't a good thing. He basically admitted to the fact that they understood
it was wrong. He admitted that it was wrong, but they were doing it for money.
That's terrible. That
yes.
No, that makes it even worse. You know, we recently interviewed Raj Patel, and he's a fascinating person. And one of the interesting things that we talked about was how this cheap ultra-processed food actually creates poverty because of the, and I never looked at it that way. It's because of the way the people that work at these factories get paid. They get paid much less, and it actually is a vicious cycle of creating sickness and poverty at the same time, which is something that's terrible.
the poorest paid people in America. Many of them are working in the food industry. They're farm workers. They're people working in meatpacking plants. They're people working in grocery stores where large percentages of them are on food stamps or SNAP, which means that taxpayers are filling in the gap in wages. They're grocery delivery people. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
And during COVID, you know, what really struck me during COVID is that they made such a big deal of maintaining the, I think it was pork industry, maintaining that as best as possible, instead of taking that opportunity to really improve the food supply in the system, you know, get some farmers to get food out to the people. But, you know, I didn't understand why the pork industry was such a big deal during the COVID epidemic.
Well, actually, the beef industry was a big deal because President Trump, exercised the Defense Production Act to keep the meatpacking plants open during the COVID, even though lots of people were getting sick and there were many deaths. And they were people in those plants were bringing COVID into their communities. At the same time that was happening, food was being destroyed because the distribution channels weren't working. And people were lined up for miles. And people were lined up for miles at food banks to get handouts of food. So I think the COVID pandemic showed flaws in the food system in ways that had never happened before. And if it did anything useful, it taught people a lot.
So what do you think needs to be done? And do you think there's hope?
Well, I love being asked that because I'm an upstream thinker. I like looking at policy levels, policy level approaches. And the first thing I would do would be to change election laws so that we have election campaign laws that do not allow corporations to give unlimited amounts of money to candidates without revealing who they are. I think everybody who runs for office should have exactly the same amount of money to spend, and it should be publicly funded. Period. End of discussion. That would end.
I agree.
That would end corruption. I also think that we need to change the way that Wall Street evaluates corporations and that corporations operate, because the current way in which corporations operate is that their primary and, in fact, only responsibility is returns to stockholders and executives. It used to be that corporations had a responsibility to the communities in which they operated and to their workers, but that stopped in the early 1980s with Reagan and with President Reagan and the onset of neoliberal thinking. I think we need to go back to a situation in which corporations are required to have social responsibility to their workers and to the communities in which they live. So, and then I think we need a complete conversion of the agricultural system to one that's focused on food, not feed for animals and fuel for automobiles.
What do you think is the responsibility of the individuals? I read something today about the Pope. He made a statement. It was about the environment. And he was saying that in Western countries, we have an irresponsible lifestyle as far as the environment is concerned. How much is that also, is it irresponsible way of eating that our individuals have? Is it all the food companies, or should there be some responsibility on the side of the individuals to not consume this ultra-processed junk that's out there?
Well, obviously both.
Yeah.
And, you know, but the system is rigged. And the system, the food system is rigged to promote consumption of ultra-processed foods, to think that that's normal, to think that eating all day long to snack, to eat in very large portions is normal. All of that has become normalized, and you can measure exactly when that started happening. You know, 70% of American adults are overweight or obese now. But that only happened starting in the 1980s when the political system changed to reduce regulation, to make profits the single most important thing that corporations did. And we live in a society in which the food system is set up to get us to eat as much as possible, as often as possible, in as large portions as possible. It's hard to fight that on your own. I think you can, and people have to be educated to do that, but it's really hard.
It is really hard for multiple reasons. And I remember I came in the United States in the 80s from Sicily, and my first shocking awareness was about sizes of things, that you walked into someone's houses and they immediately were serving a large drink, as if you hadn't been drinking all day, right? It's almost like you walked, you know, thirsty. and then, you know, there was an incredible amount of food served even before the food was, that the meal was served. And that was very, and the kids were constantly snacking, right? So the kids had a meal and then they would go for a car ride and they would pack snacks as if after a big meal, they needed to eat to half an hour later. Now, though, when I go back to Sicily, I see that the same thing is happening over there. So in a very short period of time, this has infiltrated all cultures and everywhere. And that is the saddest thing. We did not have McDonald's growing up, but now we do. And right? We have things that in Italy, you would never anticipate that could ever even happen, right? Because we were so attached to healthy food and walking to the farmer's market and getting our fruits and vegetables. But now the mothers are giving snacks to the kids there and not real food. There are packets. So it's happening everywhere.
Yes, and because we export it. Because if you corporations not only have to make a profit, and I'm not opposed to profits, not at all, but they have to grow their profits. And there's a limit to growth. There's already, you know, way more food available than most people need. So in order to sell food in that environment, you have to do a lot of different kinds of things to sell it. And one way you do it is you export it. And because American foods have this aura of modernity and, you know, they have an aura. People admire Americans for a lot of reasons. And so it's not that hard to insinuate these products into cultures, particularly because the foods taste good. People like them.
Right. That's the what we talked about before. There is this addiction. You know, when your blood sugar, you know, spikes immediately, the brain gets a reward.
Right. People like them.
It's constantly reinforced.
So I think it's, you know, in answer to your question, I think it's asking a lot of an individual to fight that system on their own. They need help. And education is important. Education helps. But when you're in an environment in which food is available all the time and everybody is eating all the time, it's pretty hard not to.
Yes, and it's pretty hard to go back to slave in the kitchen and cooking and what is, it feels that way, like I'm slaving instead of I'm preparing a meal or I'm using real food. And real food, and now we have gone so far away from it that we don't recognize it. And kids don't recognize what real food is. They really have become completely ignorant about what's real food.
You know, it depends on who they are. Some are, some aren't. But, you know, in general, yes, the trends are in the wrong direction, which is why the percentage of kids who are overweight is going up so much. And, you know, looking at class pictures of kids now as compared to class pictures when my kids were younger, when I was young, it's just the difference is astounding.
The difference is astounding. It really is.
Yeah, the kids, all the kids are bigger, you know, and the old pictures, the kids are skinny.
So you said I wrote a book about what to eat that now has a new publication. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about that, what to eat, you know.
Well, it's a book, I'm not sure I love the title because I don't really say what to eat. It's really a book about how to think about what to eat. And I used supermarkets as an organizing device. And in the book, I go through the supermarket section by section, talking about the issues that are raised in each section of the supermarket. And, you know, I mean, one of the things I point out is that, again, supermarkets are not social service agencies. Their job is to sell food, and the more of it, the better. And their entire way in which supermarkets are set up is to get you to buy more food, not less. You know, it's not an accident that the milk is always in the furthest corner from the time you walk in. It's not an accident that the fruits and vegetables are usually right up front, because those are enticing. And it's, you know, it's not an accident the way products are placed on shelves. That all of that is planned. And it's planned to encourage people to stay in the supermarket as long as possible, to linger, and to look at as many products as possible.
And then to look at the products, you know, the products that are easily reachable, the kids are...
The companies pay to put their products in exactly the places where they want them. At eye level, at the ends of aisles, at the cash registers. Yeah. And they have fortune to put their products there.
Sandra always tells a story when she first came from Italy. She would go to supermarkets and she wouldn't know what season we were in. Because
we get completely confused.
Because in Italy, everything's very, very seasonal.
We're American. We don't do seasons.
And that was really, really off-putting for me. It was disorienting. Every time I walk in the supermarket, I will feel disoriented. Is it oranges? You know, it's not November. How can we have that? Tomatoes? It's not summer. And, you know, it was really disorienting. Now I try to figure out. But the best way to really for us to understand what food really is to go to a farmer's market.
Oh, that absolutely. Then you have or grow it yourself.
Oh, grow it yourself. I just, you know, was making a salad for dinner and I just went to my backyard. I have so many tomatoes coming up and
getting. I'm dealing with Concord grapes this week.
Oh,
that's nice. But that is exciting, you know, really, really exciting because you bite into something that has a different flavor, food that can be incredibly rewarding if it is eaten in season, if it has the greatest nutrition value at the moment that you're actually consuming it. And it can, to me, it can be much more rewarding than whatever fast food that you can get. But I educated myself through the years to really love and cherish that. And I wish that others could have the same experience.
I'm a cardiologist, so I see the end effect every day of all these problems, you know, because patients end up with heart attacks and diabetes and obesity. And I don't see, like we talked about earlier, I don't see this getting better. I mean, we spend every day teaching patients about nutrition, about
lifestyle.
Farmer markets, lifestyle. But I think it's such a hard nut to crack that most patients, even after they have bypass surgery or a stent or a heart attack, they're not willing to make the major changes because the environment is not conducive to that. You know, we live in an environment
Give me a pill.
Right. Give me a pill and give me a takeout and I'm happy, you know. So that's why my original question to you about, you know, how you see this going forward. Is it getting better or is it going to get worse as we go forward? You know, looking at our children, our grandchildren, what do you think their future holds?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about educated people with money, they're doing fine for the most part. It's people without education and money who are in real trouble, in part because of the way the food system is set up to make the cost of junk food cheaper than the cost of healthier foods. And if poor people, people without money think that fruits and vegetables are expensive, it's because they are.
They are.
The cost of fruits and vegetables has gone up much, much faster than the cost of other foods. And that's Department of Commerce data. So you can look at those data and see that that's the case.
Oh, we believe it. We go to the Montclair Farmers Market. We can't walk out of there without spending at least $100.
And what you have is a bunch of tomatoes or cucumbers, and it's so expensive. So you can see how a family cannot be fed.
Yeah, and there aren't very many calories in that, and what people want is calories. And so they look for food with more concentrated calories, and that's junk food or ultra-processed foods is what we're calling them now. So that's a policy issue. And right now, the federal policy subsidizes the cost of ingredients of processed foods. It does not subsidize the cost of fruits and vegetables. Because we have an agricultural system that is designed to feed animals and to fuel automobiles, not to feed people. And so that's high on my list of policy changes that I think are needed.
Well, I was reading an article from the American Heart Association recently, and they're really, for the first time, the American Heart Association is coming out stating food is medicine.
Yes, food is medicine.
And that to really think that what they would love to see is by 2030, when patients come into a cardiologist's office with chronic diseases, that they can actually be order a meal plan to be delivered to them, and that would be paid by insurances. Mm-hmm. That'd be fantastic if that ever happens. It wouldn't be fantastic if school really are going to abolish all fast food, ultra processed foods, sodas, like you said, and to be able to completely eliminate that, at least from one meal a day for the kids.
And we live in a society that doesn't have a healthcare system. So what's going to happen to all of the people who are going to have these chronic diseases as a result of what they're eating and whatever their other habits are? At some point, the system is going to completely crash because nobody is going to be able to afford it. It's not that everybody who is overweight is going to get type 2 diabetes or develop a bad heart or any of those things, but the risk is much higher, particularly for type 2 diabetes.
Particularly if you start young, obesity, the younger you start, the higher is going to be the chance that you will develop one of those chronic illnesses. But now we have studies that are starting to support that even eating, processed food is not just bad for your heart, it's not bad for your diabetes, you're not going to get a stroke, but you're going to get depression, you're going to get anxiety. So ultra-processed food is highly associated with depression.
Those are correlational studies, and it's I think there's more research is needed on that point. But there is one controlled study that shows that ultra-processed foods encourage people to eat more, and that study, which is phenomenally well controlled, it was done in a metabolic ward where people couldn't cheat or lie about what they were eating. That's all you need to know. The people who were eating that diet didn't realize they were eating more. They had no idea. And they were taking in 500 calories more a day on average. That's an extraordinary amount.
And I think I read about this study. This is they could eat ad libitum, right? They could eat whatever they wanted, either ultra processed foods or non processed food. And they, and with the processed foods, I think what you're saying is that they just ended up eating like more calories per day.
Right. Yeah. And didn't know it. The diets were designed so well and were matched in protein, fat, carbohydrate, vitamins, minerals, fiber. They also were matched in flavor profile. So they were equally delicious and people could eat as much of them as they wanted. When they were on the ultra processed diet, they ate an average of 500 calories more a day and gained weight, obviously. When they were on the unprocessed or minimally processed diet, they lost weight. And they couldn't tell the difference between the diets.
I mentioned something in our book, and I don't know if this supports this. There's, I think our bodies have something called nutritional intelligence, where our cells need food. We need nutrition. I don't know if this is what is at the basis of something like this, where your body is just looking for nutrition. There you're getting empty calories with the ultra processed foods. So you eat more and more of that for your body before it feels satisfied, before it gets satiety.
The guy who did that study is a very good scientist and he's trying to figure out why. But in the meantime, until they find out why, the message is pretty clear. If you're worried about weight, don't eat a lot of ultra processed foods.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, you're not getting nutrition. You're getting something else, but you're not getting nutrition. So
you're getting calories.
Right, calories, exactly.
So this is, you know, incredibly informative for our audience, for ourselves, you know, that I think we're all trying to do our best to inform and teach and change even small things that can make a big difference. And I know you do that every day of your life. And you tell me, when you teach your college level, what kind of response do you get from your students?
Well, I teach in a food studies department.
Pre-selected.
They're pre-selected. They're either food or nutrition students who want to change the world through food. And so they're very interested in, you know, in using food to create healthier and more sustainable environments. So I, in a sense, I'm teaching to the converted, and I'm not anymore, you know, I'm not teaching broad courses. I'm not even teaching anymore because I'm retired, but in general, the students that I interact with are interested to use food to try to improve the world, which is exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. And your book, Food Politics.
They're pretty great to teach.
Yeah, that must be a wonderful thing to have done all these years. And but, you know, your book, Food Politics, is, it's a systems kind of look at, you know, what's happening. What would the people that listen to our podcast are very interested in this whole subject. What would you recommend besides having a good diet? How can they help influence this positive change? You know, what to do, things to do.
Well, every time they make a food choice, they're voting with their fork. So the kind of food system they want. So those are important choices because individuals influence the people who are around them. Often. And if you're making a food choice in a certain way and you have certain beliefs about food, the people who are in your social circle will sometimes follow you or do the same thing because that's what social circles do. So I think that individual choices are very important in that way. But then I think everybody needs to get involved in the politics of food. Because it's too important to be left to politicians. And that means joining organizations that are working on food issues. Pick a food issue that interests you and join other people who are doing it. When students ask me what they should do, my first response is run for office. You know, if you want real power, that's how you get it.
That's
You know, go to Congress, try to you know, join the people who are trying to do some things in Congress. But I think everybody needs to understand the way the political system works. And the one of the gratifying things that's happened in recent years is I think more and more people are catching on to the way the politics works. You know, just to give one example, I would say 5 or 6 years ago, I could not use the word capitalism in class without making students enormously uncomfortable. Now, because I got in the habit of not using it, people say, but aren't you talking about capitalism? You know, and that comes up over and over and over again. So I think there's much more willingness, particularly among younger people, to see the system for what it is and to try to figure out how to change it into one that would be better for people and the planet.
Yeah, and we have the added complexity of the internet. You know, you, when you started your career, it was, it may have been before we had internet and blogospheres and all these other issues. Like, you are a true expert, and I'm sure people looked at your opinion as an expert. Now, it's so confusing for patients, because I see patients, they bring me stuff that they read about, you know, on Google or on the internet. And, you know, obviously it's not the best information. The algorithm is not for best information. It's just the most popular one. So, you know, that I think that adds to the difficulty in actually moving forward in this realm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's just so much information out there, and it's so difficult for people to parse. And, you know, I hear all the time, why should I believe you? You know, it's I don't know how to answer that question. I don't know.
Because I know how to read a study.
You know, I read a lot, and I write a daily blog at foodpolitics.com. And the, I don't know, you know, I try to cite sources and to be pretty scientifically rigorous, giving my opinion based on the way I see it. And I'm perfectly happy to debate my opinions with people.
Thank God we have you. Yeah. You know, I like that. I like that you still have all, you today retired, but it doesn't sound very much that you're retired. Okay? You write a blog every day, you're involved in politics, you're still teaching, you're still learning. But I love what you said.
I'm very fortunate.
You're very fortunate.
But also very inspirational. I think that's inspirational. What we aim to do with our patients is improve health span, you know, to have people live well and long and have a very have vitality in their life till the very end. And, you know, people like you who are, leading this area, but, you know, like in a lot of other areas, I think it's very inspirational.
Thank you.
And I also love very much what you said. You have to vote where you're for. I really got it when you said it before. Even every time you're making a food choice, you're voting with your fork. And I love that. Most of the time when you're using a fork, you're eating real food, you're making the right choice. And the choice is not just for your own health, but it's for the planet health and it's other people around you's health.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because the food system has such an enormous effect on greenhouse gas emissions and what's happening on the planet and land use and water use and all of those things. It's intimately tied up with that. And we know that diets, you know, and I think dietary advice is so easy that I quote the journalist Michael Pollan all the time, eat food, not too much, mostly plants. And that really takes care of it. And you can eat deliciously that way without having too many restrictions. But
that's what I come in. I always love that. I love to cook. I love to cook well. I love to cook deliciously. And nobody should ever be deprived of taste in eating well.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Very good. So we thank you very, very much for your time and expertise.
Yeah, this has been a wonderful discussion. Thank you, Marion.
Well, that's really nice to meet you. This was a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
If you are new to the show, welcome. And if you are returning, we are so grateful for your participation and support. We hope you go to iTunes or Spotify and subscribe to the show, leave feedback, write a review, or send questions. They love questions and look at every question that is submitted. The content of the Sicilian Secret Diet are meant for educational purposes only and are not meant to be a medical diagnosis or treatment advice. A doctor-patient relationship is not created, and any questions related to your specific physical or mental health should be directed to your healthcare practitioner. So hello, and thank you for joining Sandra and Giovanni for another episode of the Sicilian Secret Diet Plan podcast.